Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Priyanka Basu about The Poet's Song, Folk and Its Cultural Politics in South Asia. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Dave. It's an honor to be here and to be speaking about my book.
Well, the pleasure is mine. This is absolutely fascinating. It's an incredible history book. It's an ethnography. It's a book of musical and literary criticism. It's a book about film and screen. It's a book about social change. It's a book about gender politics. It's absolutely incredible, the range of themes and ideas that are in the book. And at the core is, and I'm sort of slightly intrigued about how to describe it, is Kobe Gan, this song contest. Rap battle, almost kind of engaged and possibly sort of site-specific theatre. It's an incredible cultural form, and it forms the centre of the book. So I wonder if you could kind of introduce it a little bit and say, I suppose, why you're interested in writing a book about it.
Thanks for that question, Dave. Well, Kobe Gan is a Bengali word, which can be divided into two words, Kobi, which means a poet, and Gan, which means song, which tells you why the book is named The Poet's Song, because Kobe Gan is the song of the poet. Now, it has been variously understood, really, as a form, as a genre. Very roughly speaking, it is a song contest. It is a song battle between two groups of performers. And there is a very strong element of debate or logical argument that flows throughout the performance. However, it's also been considered as a kind of song theater, largely because of, you know, the melodramatic gestures that the performers use, the enactment that they use in the performance, and a little bit of very nascent dance gestures or dance movements they are often seen doing on stage. So in that sense, Kobe Gan is both verse-dwelling song contest and song theater. And it shares some of its characteristics, especially the element of debate, which involves a lot of, you know, satire and humor, attacking the opponent through, you know, short, humorous questions and answers. This is something similar to many genres which are found across South Asia. And I've mentioned some of this in my book, the genres that are found in India, but also, you know, beyond India, in Nepal, in Sri Lanka, in Bangladesh, in Pakistan. So there is this element of debate in all of these genres. And Kobe Gan becomes, you know, one of the representatives of those genres in verse dwelling. Now, the history of Kobe Gan is quite contested. And if you look at the literary history of Bengal, the way authors have understood it really is a kind of genre which has been imported into the colonial urban center of Calcutta in the 19th century. So amongst the many village forms of performances, this was imported to the city, patronized by the then feudal lords in the city. And we see a range of performers, especially Dalit, people coming from the so-called lower castes who are employed in different kinds of professions. They are the ones who are singing Kobe Gan in the city, but also traveling as itinerant troops outside the city as well. So my inspiration towards writing this book came when I was really in my undergrad, and I was studying in a college in North Calcutta, which has most of the old theater houses in the city. And it's a very rich part of the city, very rich in terms of the history of performances, theater, literature, print culture. And my interest in the form was largely historical until when I came to do my PhD and I started speaking to people to realize that it's still practiced in, you know, there are contemporary performances of this form in India, in West Bengal, and in Bangladesh. And that made me embark upon an ethnographic journey along with the performers and to see really if I could bring the history of Kobigan as the literary history gives us, the clean literary history of Kobigan and all the messiness around an ethnographic journey with the genre itself. So that is kind of my inspiration with which I started looking at Kobigan performances.
I mean, that... How did you put it? You know, that kind of clean literary history is made messy in several different ways by the book. I think one thing is the kind of ethnographic elements that are in the book and your immersion in the culture. But the other thing I think is the places. And one of the things that's so fascinating is you've got Bangladesh and West Bengal, and you've got... how would I describe it? Two very distinctive places with distinctive kind of takes on Kobigan. And in particular, it'd be good to hear about how they kind of differ, what the similarities are before we start to unpack which is the, if I might say, most authentic of the two.
Okay, thanks for that question, Dave. And well, authenticity is probably something I'm still trying to understand in terms of Kobigan. It's not very easy to ascertain what is authentic. And rather than asking which one is authentic, my aim in understanding Kobigan was to really see how the context of authenticity changes depending on the performers, the audiences, the patrons who are endorsing Kobigan. So I started my ethnographic journey with Kobigan in West Bengal, which is the Eastern Indian state in India. And I started by talking to the performers known as Kobials in West Bengal. They are known as Shorkars in Bangladesh. So I started with the Kobials in West Bengal. And what emerged in the process was a very straightforward structure of the performance, which have I outlined in the book, which is an invocation, and then moving on to the topic of the debate, which is given on spot by the, you know, the sponsoring organization or the committee who invite the performers to perform. And then the verse dwelling, the debate on the topic, and then the conclusion with a kind of, you know, a duet song by the two performers and the performing troops. Now, this is the kind of structure that I came across in West Bengal, whereas when I moved to Bangladesh, it was a much, much longer, more complicated structure involving, a lot of, elements or segments, which are introduced largely for an audience. It has a religious implication because it's sermonizing, it's entertainment, it's performing, but it's also an opportunity on stage for amateur performers, young performers, to be trained by the more veteran or the star performers. So Bangladeshi Kobigan in that sense includes way more, intricacies and segments, which makes it look like very complicated. And I have kind of listed what the elements are in the second chapter of my book, which I call Nomenclatures, and really describing what these elements are. Now, the other major difference between Kobigan in West Bengal and Kobigan in Bangladesh has to do with the socio-political and, political and cultural history of the two regions. In West Bengal, there's a strong element of Kobigan being people's song or protest song, which has to do with, the influence of the Marxist cultural movement, also nationalist movement, in the Bengal region. Whereas in Bangladesh, again, given its history from being, East Bengal to East Pakistan to Bangladesh, there is a strong sense of national heritage and culture which is attached to folk forms and folk genres. So in two regions, therefore, I see these two different trends, which are also expressed in contemporary practices with this form of Kobigan. But the similarity between the two regions and in the way Kobigan is practiced or understood is kind of guided by the fact that it's a form that is nearly extinct or obsolete or is not found anymore. So the idea of extinction is key to the performance of Kobigan and, writing the literary history of Kobigan. So there's this extinction of the genre, but also the ideas of revival and also how to make it a clean, respectable genre endorsed by organizations or institutions who preserve and conserve folklore and folk performances and folk genres.
Yeah, the book does an incredibly brilliant job, actually, of teasing out that sense of alive artistic practice that is also something that is subject to kind of heritage practices being, consecrated, being almost kind of, studied and analysed in ways that are not part of the art form itself. And that's, I think, a kind of key topic as you're delving into the history in the book, and I sort of urge the listeners to engage with that and read it. But I wonder if we could continue talking about this kind of theme of authenticity, because slightly later on in the book, you delve into the kind of other life of Kobigan on the screen, whether, film and television. And I'm kind of fascinated to know a bit about whether Kobigan is still Kobigan when it's on screen, how it has been kind of depicted, and the extent to which it's seen debates and battles over whether it is an authentic form when it's being transferred to another medium.
Right. So as I was saying, the issue of authenticity is quite complicated in understanding Kobigan. But there are a few issues around authenticity that I have found playing and replaying through the performances that I have witnessed and also through my interviews and conversations with the performers. So there is this idea that authenticity in Kobigan is a kind of a binding force that allows them to kind of build or craft an identity for themselves as a group. Now, in my book, I have identified three distinct groups of performers who are potential claimants to their version of authentic Kobigan. So there's this group of Kobials in West Bengal. There are the Sharkars in Bangladesh. But there is also a third group of claimant who I have called the Borderland Sharkars or the Borderland performers who are, again, Dalit performers coming from the so-called lower castes and showing their affinity based on their caste identity, the oppression of caste that they have historically faced, showing their affinity and brotherhood with the performers in Bangladesh. So Authenticity here is therefore largely related to the identity formation of these groups. But in West Bengal especially, authenticity of Kobigan is also what we see during the performance, especially in the onset of the performance, the introductory sections of the performance where the performer takes the performance back and relates it to the history, literary history of Kobigan, and creates a lineage of poet singers and poets in general. So this kind of also alludes to what I was saying about a clean history, a respectable history of Kobigan, which is then attached to its authenticity. The authenticity of Kobigan is also attached to the cultural memory of Kobigan, and here is where the role of cinema comes in. And cinema, as I have shown in my chapter on the history of films on Kobigan, starting from 1949 till about 1980, Bengali cinema had a distinct way of portraying sound, or creating prototypes of folk sound on screen, which then went on to become the blueprint of what folk sound should be and what folk sound for Kobigan as a folk genre should be on screen. And this is tied to the authenticity of sound and music, which is then represented on screen, and tied also to the cultural memory of audiences, especially in fairs and festivals, where we see truncated performances of Kobigan, and where audiences are more eager and more keen to hear Kobigan sound and music, which are influenced by films, or which are represented, which are necessarily somewhat film songs. So as we see here, there are different ways in which the Kobiyal, the Shorkar, the performers of Kobigan, they are trying to negotiate authenticity. So on the one hand, they would say that the long rural performances of Kobigan, which are between 8 and 10 hours long, they are the most authentic. But again, when they are performing in fairs and festivals, or if they are taking the performances to be represented in cinema or on television, they do adhere to this idea of authenticity, which then becomes the authentic battle or verse dwelling or debate component of the genre. So that has to be the most authentic to represent Kobigan as authentically to the audience.
You mentioned the I suppose kind of shorter versions in the context of things like fairs and festivals. And I'm fascinated to know a bit about how Kobigan has transferred, or perhaps, the limitations of transferring it to more kind of city or urban audiences. Is it, I suppose, kind of thriving in the urban context, or are there these ongoing struggles? Both, as we come back to, and you've rightly mentioned around the kind of complexity of authenticity, or is the urban audience kind of providing a new way for the genre to carry on?
Yes. So in terms of fairs and festivals, so this is, again, chapter 5 in my book, which I have called Temporary Exhibits. And here I'm looking at three different fairs and festivals, which are all not necessarily urban festivals. So one of them is a rural festival. The other is peri-urban rural, whereas the last one is an urban festival in the city of Dhaka, which is interestingly the Hay Literary Festival, which was taking place in Dhaka at the time I was there doing my fieldwork, and it had a Kobigan performance, which was necessarily geared to a very international cosmopolitan audience. So I would say that urban audiences do have a very definitive role to play in the way Kobigan is represented in fairs and festivals. I try and look at it as the festivalization of culture, But I also look at Kobe Gunn as a kind of intangible product, which is displayed especially in rural and peri-urban fairs, alongside the objects, the cultural objects or crafts that are displayed at these fairs and festivals. And what does the display mean for the performer or the group of performers who are trying to create an identity for themselves? So in this chapter on where I look at fairs and festivals, performances of Kobe Gunn, I'm also trying to see how it contributes towards an objectified capital, which the performers then utilize to get, as I have shown in the book, to acquire an institution dedicated to the training of Kobe Gunn's performers, a Kobe Gunn Academy for themselves. So there are these different stages of acquiring, the different stages of capital, and fairs and festivals are one way showcasing Kobe Gunn in a way that contributes towards the acquiring of objectified capital.
The final chapter, which I must admit I found the most fascinating, actually, is around the gendered politics of Kobe Gunn. And a sort of a slightly flippant question is, well, where are the women in this story? But I think that it is a route into a much bigger issue around what is clearly, again, a struggle over who is and who is not included. And actually thinking about your term, the idea of the acquisition of capitals, who has the capital to kind of stake out a claim to being involved. So where are women in the story of Kobe Gunn? And I suppose, how have you tried to kind of reconstruct some of that history, which is, very hidden, often not in the kind of, literary record, and is really, a distinctive project in itself to reconstruct?
Yes, I mean, it has been a real challenge trying to talk about and write about the woman Kobe Gunn because of, this very visible lack of documentation. And this is not just about women Kobe Gunns, it is about women performers, and it's not just South Asia, but a global phenomenon and a global problem, really. So my intention in this chapter was to listen to the women Kobe Gunns that I have worked with. Unfortunately, I had access to only 5 of them in West Bengal. I couldn't trace women Kobe Gunns in Bangladesh. And at that point, when I was traveling for my fieldwork in West Bengal, there were only 5 performers. And I worked with them, I listened to them, and what really fascinated me while talking to one of the veteran women Kobe Gunns in West Bengal was this need on her part to write her memoir, to write her biography. And this kind of led me to the history of women performers, especially in 19th century Bengal, the lack of documentation, and leading me to the biography, the autobiography of one of the late 19th century, early 20th century stage actress, whose story is very popularly known. And this kind of guided me towards the gender politics that informs Kobe Gunn, where women are trying to form a collective. And I have talked about, the politics, the complexities of, and the possibilities and impossibilities of this collective by looking at them through one of the fairs, the Kobe Gunn Fair, the Kobe Gunn Festival and Fair, which takes place in one of the villages in West Bengal, and how we see women Kobe Gunns coming from different ethnic, caste and class backgrounds in this space, and why then it becomes necessary for them to be more exemplary than be part of a collective, which they are definitely aspiring to. But what are the impediments which then pushes them to be more exemplary than work as a collective? So that's something that I was looking at in terms of understanding the woman Kobe Gunns. But The other more important, very vital issue of being a woman, Kobiyal, is to constantly battle a patriarchal attitude of being a fallen woman as a performing woman. And this has a long history, which I have tried to show in my book. It has a very long history and a continued attitude, really. And how women, Kobiyals, are trying to battle that, and not just on stage, and why then print a biography, autobiography becomes important towards earning that kind of respectability. So the narrative of respectability is something that guides the practice, the understanding of Kobigan throughout the course of the book, as I have shown. But I was also trying to look at women Kobiyals who have left their traditional practices of a distinct type of craft and performance, which is scroll painting. So I've tried to look at the stories of two women coming from that same caste background, but one has chosen Kobigan as a platform for empowerment of, having their own agency, whereas the other woman remains part of a collective craft practice. And what does it tell us about this lack of documentation, about the dearth of women in Kobigan? Now, very interestingly, I was in one of the fairs, the winter fair in Shantiniketan, which I have talked about in my book. I was there in December, after a long break over the pandemic. And I was very fortunate to see one of the women performers I had documented way back in 2013. She was back on stage performing and singing on a topic which was man versus woman. And I had the opportunity to speak to her after her performance. And the number of women Kobiyals in West Bengal has not grown significantly. So she informed me that there has been just two additions. So two new women performers who have joined. But the number roughly remains between 6 and 7. So which, and 10 years have passed in between 2013 and 2023, which still makes us question, how gender politics, how gender, and how performing, women performing within this patriarchal setup and attitude is still something to be noted and to be considered when talking about folk performances like Kobigan.
I mean, what do you think is the future for Kobigan? Is it a cultural practice that has, I suppose, a sort of secure position in the context of, the sort of ever-changing patterns of urban rural development, questions of heritage and linguistic, preservation, these kind of live issues in both, cultural policy, but also in heritage studies? Or are you sort of, I suppose, more fearful for its longevity, particularly, I suppose, in the context of perhaps the exclusions of caste and gender that you've flagged up in the book and in our conversation?
For me, I think I'm not fearful of the longevity of the genre because, as I have shown in the book, it is a revived genre. It has been revived not once, but at several points in the history of the region, which includes both West Bengal and Bangladesh. What would guide the life of Kobigan in the future is definitely the way they are showcased in fairs and festivals. So my intention is to look at the larger festivalization of culture guided by, political patrons, political attitudes, especially now that, the rubric of politics in India has been transforming for a few years now. And what contributions does that have towards the showcasing or the preservation of genres like Kobigan, which then again talks about, which then leads us to, talking about the ownership of the genre, who owns the genre. So I do see the continuities of the questions that I have been trying to engage in this in the course of this book, there is a continuity of these questions in the future life of Kobi Khan as well. But I also see a serious role of new media, of social media, of online platforms in being a certain kind of archive for this form. And this was mentioned to me even when I was talking to the performers, years ago while doing my fieldwork, where they looked at new media, for example, video CDs, as preserving, documenting, and archiving Kobi Khan, especially for that, marginal group from where they came. So YouTube, performances of Kobi Khan, or TikTok, or even Reels. So these I feel would be new ways of archiving Kobi Khan, and the way I have looked at Kobi Khan in the book, through rural performances, through its literary history, institutions, fairs and festivals, cinema, new media. I think in terms of media, new media, there would be much more proliferation and transformation in the form, in the way Kobi Khan is performed. New elements might be added, elements might be taken out, but what should be there is the element of debate or verse dwelling, which kind of becomes, the guiding factor for the authenticity of Kobi Khan. That's my feeling of how it would continue.
I mean, the book, as I said at the start, is so incredibly rich, and you've mentioned actually just the sheer length of time that the book has been kind of percolating in terms of your thinking and your engagement with the genre. So it seems a bit sort of slightly unfair now to be like, so what are you doing next? But it strikes me that you've already outlined, I think, a new research agenda in terms of the digital manifestations of Kobi Khan. But also, I suppose there's lots of other kind of possibilities for future work that maybe aren't about the genre and the cultural practice. So what are your sort of research plans for kind of now and next?
Well, your first book, your first research really doesn't ever leave you. So there would be continuities from this research. My continued interest with the folk performances, not just in India, but beyond, in Bangladesh, in Pakistan, even here in the UK, really looking at the history of preservation and conservation of folk practices. So I do intend to work with folk performances. So a couple of years ago, I was traveling in Bangladesh looking at a practice which is tied to the cult of the snake goddess in the region. It's not just West Bengal and Bangladesh, but it's found all over South Asia. So I was looking at, how climate crisis, religious fundamentalism have informed these practices and what transformations are taking place. So that is something I intend to pursue. But given my broader interest in performance and the cultural history of theatre and performance, I have started a new project, which is looking at the cultural history of two dancers from Bangladesh, but even before Bangladesh, when it was East Bengal and East Pakistan. So their work, their cultural work, really, in instituting a modern dance for Pakistan, which is not really, it hasn't been researched a lot. So my interest is looking at the journeys of these performers when they were traveling in Europe in the 1950s and bringing that sense of modern dance, creating a vocabulary, their experiences of performing, traveling in the UK and Europe, and taking some vocabularies back to institute a modern dance for Pakistan. So as a dancer, as a practitioner, this is something which is of great interest to me. And so this is a work that I have started doing. A third work, which is kind of related to the my interest in folk forms is tied to the idea of a sound for the nation. So I have started looking at Koch Studio Bangladesh, which started during the pandemic in 2021. And it has just completed two seasons where there is this, you know, the curators are trying to bring folk sound into the studio space and experimenting with it, which then is a kind of tagged as the sound of the nation. So I'm trying to look at it through the lens of nationalism, through the lens of, you know, festivalization of culture and sound, and how does it, you know, create this idea of homogeneous sound for a nation, and what implications does that have towards actual cultural practices, livelihoods, and sustenance for the folk performers in the region?